Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness some scenes from the next attraction to play this theater. This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium for the next 90 seconds.
Well, good evening, friends. Welcome to this week's episode of the Video Nasty Project. Tonight, we're bringing you a look at an underrated horror flick, one that's really nobody has ever heard of, and that's a damn shame because it's a really good flick with some really good talent. It was written by Dan O'Bannon. It had the special effects done by Stan Winston. Tonight's movie? It's Dead and Buried. Why don't you check out the trailer?
From the creators of Alien, terror brought down to Earth. Fear, so intense, it will stay with you to the grave and beyond.
Welcome to Potter's Bluff.
What? Yeah, what are you doing?
Two murders, Dobbs. Both strangers. Two murders in a town no bigger than a postage stamp.
When you die in Potter's Bluff, expect the unexpected.
All right, just lie still. I'm gonna give you something. It's gonna make you feel even better.
What the hell is going on in this town? A kind of maniac is loose out there. First murderers, now body snatching. God, I can't believe it!
Potter's Bluff. A nice place to visit. But you wouldn't want to die there.
Professional opinion. Is there any way whatsoever to reanimate people after they have died?
Oh, so lovely. So frail. So young. How could anyone mar such loveliness?
And here... I will make you beautiful again. Even more beautiful than before.
What did you do to our Dobbs?
You will try to kill me, Dad. But you can't. You can only make me dead.
Go on. Pull the trigger.
Perhaps you need a little more motivation.
Dan, I'm dead. Please bury me.
Dead and Buried, the movie you'll want to see, if you dare to look.
Bury me.
Dead and Buried.
And welcome back. We just saw Dead and Buried.
So, I mean, when you presented me with this season's list, and you said, what do you want to do? And after everything that happened to me last season, I want to do fun movies. This was the first movie I picked. A, because I remembered enjoying it, and B, it's like, oh, this is a good one, and it will not make me feel like I need to, you know, exfoliate.
So the movie is this little town called Potter's Bluff. It really sucker punches you, because there's this photographer comes down to the beach, and he's taking pictures of, like, wrecked ships and refuse on the beach and whatnot, and this girl wanders into shot. And they start flirting a little bit back and forth, and then she, like, shows her tits off, and he starts taking her picture, and then all of a sudden, a bunch of people out of nowhere just jump him.
Well, I felt that in that scene, though, I could feel an underlie of tension in that. It's like, okay, he meets this random girl. She's really coming on to him. Where's the other shoe? And I did have a sense of there is another shoe going to drop. And again, I think part of it, I'm watching a horror movie, and this is way too happy. You know, this is either the beginning of a porno or something really terrible is about to happen.
And something very terrible happens to
him.
So, in and about the town of Potter's Bluff, you have these a series of murders happening. You have the camera guy, he gets killed. You have a drunk vagrant wandering through town at the boatyard, he gets killed. So the movie is this, it's not so much a whodunit. It's more of, because we know straight away that the villagers, or at least a large portion of the villagers, are doing it. It's more of a why done it.
Why is this happening? What's the end game? Because there's way too many people involved for it to be anything at all random. There's organization. There's an end goal.
And then that's where we meet our protagonist lead of the piece, the sheriff, who is running around trying to figure out, why are these people dying? Who are these people that are coming into town and getting killed? What's going on here? And trying to uncover the bigger conspiracy.
And they start building the mythos of what is going on, because after the second murder, one of the reveals, we're in spoiler territory, so, the first murder victim, Freddy, is, which is the name they give him, it's not his real name, he's set on fire, and when that doesn't immediately kill him, in the hospital, this horribly burned man, he gets the stab through the eye. A few scenes later, before the family murder, we go to the diner where they're asking for directions, and they need gas, and the gas attendant turns around, and it's Freddy.
Yeah.
It's the guy who was murdered early in the movie, looking perfectly healthy now.
And not a third-degree burn all over 90% of his body.
And since we know Freddy wasn't his real name, it was the name...
It
was George. It was the name the girl had given him, but now they're calling him Freddy as a thing on his chest that says Freddy. So suddenly he's part of the village.
Yeah.
And that's our first inkling of somewhat what's going on. I'll be honest, when I first saw the movie in my youth, I was thinking ghosts, which is not far off.
No, I could clearly see why you'd think ghosts, because like when the family's driving along, they have this white flash of something running in front of the road, and the wife's like, I didn't see anybody. What's going on?
Yeah.
So the big picture, the big spoiler of the movie is that this is a zombie-filled town. But it's not a traditional Romero shoot him in the head, eat brains.
It's not
zombie.
A Hollywood zombie.
It's not a Hollywood zombie. It's a Haitian zombie movie.
So more akin to White Zombie or I Walked with a Zombie in the... They are reanimated servitors.
Yeah. It was at the point when the vagrant, his death, it was when that death occurred, I hit pause, because the original thought, the thought that started inkling in my head was that, I got this feeling, the people that are, all of these people, they're dead.
The feel of death and decay, and again, this is the very much using the main setting, the town feels claustrophobic.
Yeah.
It's a small town, but it's also...
A very isolated town.
Isolated, and everything's run down.
Yeah.
The paint is peeling. There are cobwebs. A lot of the cars are in disrepair.
There's like when they go into the diner and like the counter is just like covered in dust. And like, yeah, just cobwebs off the light fixtures.
So if you're paying attention, that sense of death is everywhere is very much represented just in the town itself and the setting. And so... That works in with the theme later, and we don't need to extrapolate why that is. It's a good piece of atmosphere that lends to, and probably helps lend to, why you are able to catch the feeling early on of, oh, everyone's dead, because everything's dead.
One of the other themes that I noticed prevalent throughout the whole movie was that, and getting back to the time out of the town out of time from when we were talking earlier, that the movie is very old-fashioned. Like the server in the diner, she's wearing like what you would expect somebody from the 30s and 40s to be wearing. Freddy, his gas station uniform,
very 50s.
Like he was one of the guys who would come running out to your car and wipe your windscreen
with a hat and everything.
Yeah.
Whenever we have Dobbs, usually in his mortuary or in his car, it's that old big band music.
Yeah, he's got a big gramophone with the needles that you put down, and it's playing, you know, Benny Goodman.
Yeah.
Dobbs, by the way, is the town coroner. Should introduce him. Also, our villain.
Also played by Uncle Charlie, or the man from Chico and the Man.
Jack Albert.
Jack Albert, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was, and it unfortunately was his next to last film.
He had cancer when he was doing this movie and yeah. died pretty much right after the movie premiered.
So we've got our sheriff, Dan.
Who, okay, you have the whole town in this stasis bubble. He's the only one that's like modern. He's come in from outside. He's got some big city learning. Mm-hmm. I thought he was an interesting contrast.
We can, later on, we can examine, you know, one of my chief questions is, when did some of these people die? We know who the first one was because Dobbs tells us. And then when did all, and clearly they are killing people who come to town to fill out the town. Because once they kill someone, they reanimate them and they are then absorbed into the community. So it's a question, when exactly did Dan die? Because there was pretty much, there was a, when we see the footage of his death, there was pretty good crowd around him. So most of the people were, there was at least a handful of people already there at that time.
It sounded like he came back in from the big city recently. So mm-hmm. he was probably a recent addition to the stable.
Although there is a hint from Dobbs that this is not the first time he's figured it out and that Dobbs just keeps resetting his memory. Which I think he maybe does too. That's kind of where I get the question. How long has some of this been going on? Do people figure it out and then Dobbs just resets everything again to get it back to where he likes it?
So basically what you're saying is this is a Sims player that has a save state that he likes.
Yeah. We also have the sheriff's wife, Janet, who is played by Melody Anderson, who was Dale Arden in the Flash Gordon movie. And what's interesting is there's a lot of red herrings that she's our actual villain.
She is the one who has like the witchcraft book and this weird ceremonial knife. She's got this class with her kids because she's a teacher. And she's talking about like how voodoo works and how witchcraft works. So it's she plays it very sinisterly.
But there was also, I felt, some subtle foreshadowing when Dan is revealed to be one of the zombies. The obvious source of decay when he starts decaying is his hands. And in an earlier scene, you see him scratching his hands kind of almost obsessively. So to me, that was just a real... And it might have just been James Ferentino, who plays Dan, just doing throwing a little thing in as a hint because he knew that sequence was coming up. So James Ferentino as the sheriff is... He's good through most of the movie, but when he gets emotional, he really starts getting scenery between his teeth.
He's really acting for the cheap seats.
He really is. And Albert, I think, on the other hand, a little bit more restrained.
I loved the hell out of him in that role. And he was brilliant.
Yeah, knew what he was doing. And actually, I think Melody Anderson, I think she had a good feel of where her parameters were based on what had been done to her. So I don't think she ever quite, other than I think where the director wanted it to go, I don't think she ever goes terribly over the top. The rest of the cast pretty much underplays. I mean, this is a very, you know, it's a lower tone movie. This is not an action film.
Not by stretch.
By any
stretch.
And the fact that you have so many solid character actors and people who would go on to be bigger deals late years later. One of the townsfolk is Robert Englund.
In like his very, very early roles.
I mean, this is, I'm pretty sure, pre-V. Barry Corbin from War Games and Northern Exposure. And again, he's just one of the townsfolks. And there's a whole bunch of, really, it's the movie is peppered with, hey, it's that guy actors. The girl who seduces the first victim played Deborah Winger's best friend in Officer and a Gentleman. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of actors who, okay, sure, there maybe no one was a big, the only big name in the movie is England.
Yeah.
Although, again, a lot of them are solid character actors who, many of them still have active careers. Those that are still alive.
And you could probably make a case that Jack Albert's was a big name in his day.
He was probably the biggest name in the movie going into it. Again, for having Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Chico and the Man behind him.
Yeah, and he did The Poseidon Adventure, too.
Yeah. And for the character, solid choice. And that, I think in the end is that even though there was, again, a lot of the changing hands of studios, a lot of behind-the-scenes things that could have derailed it, I think overall, it in the end, was just a solid... it was a solid enough script and a solid enough idea that it carried through And again, it of the movies we've watched for the series, it's certainly one of the most enjoyable.
Oh, far and away. It was a big studio production, so it's very slick. It clearly has money behind it. So it is far and away what we usually don't get with your typical video nasty. Yeah.
I think the biggest problem it faced was because, again, we're in the era of Friday the 13th, that it was not a hit. It got a cult following later, but in of itself was not a box office hit. Yeah. Although, interestingly, apparently the novelization did fairly well. That may have also been that at the time, the author, Chelsea Quinn Yarborough, was successful in the horror genre for her vampire novels, the Saint Germain series.
Yeah.
The movie falls into that same trap that, like, The Changeling with George C. Scott, which is a brilliant ghost story.
One of my favorites.
But it got lost in the mad rush for slasher movies.
Yeah. The plot twist devices when it comes to films, I think that one of the more recent modern films that would be akin to this, am I thinking correctly? The Sixth Sense? Yep.
A lot of people wonder if M. Night Shyamalan didn't take inspiration, at least partially, from this. Although, again, this feels more Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
But Twilight Zone always had some twist. Yeah. And that's where this is. This has a Twilight Zone twist. Although the twist at the end of this one is very much the same twist at the end of Sixth Sense. The protagonist was dead,
was
all,
dead
along.
All along. Yeah.
Yeah. If not Twilight Zone, Outer Limits.
So for me, that part almost harkens back to Lovecraft and Shadows Over Innsmouth, where, again, you've got the creepy village, there's something going on, it turns out everyone in the village is wrong. But I don't know those so much inspirations as it's a kind of thing that works in that setting. And again, I think the author...
Clichés are a cliché for a reason.
Yeah, and I think it's just the case of the writer went, I've got this great idea. And my guess is the idea was always everyone in the town is dead. I'm sure that's where he started from and then built out from there. Kudos to him for avoiding, because I have a bad feeling if somebody tried to make this movie today, there somehow would be cannibalism from the zombies, because that seems to have, thanks to Romero and the cultural impact, even people who do Haitian zombies these days...
Can't get away from
cannibalism, and that was never part of the original folklore.
So do you have a favorite moment from the movie? Because I got one.
I think for me, I don't know, I think it's because the image stuck with me from the first time I watched it way back when, but there is a really striking moment to me. It's in that first kill with Freddy, when... You know, they've got him tied up. And then you have the woman who's not the one who initially honey-trapped him.
The
one from the diner just nonchalantly walks up to him, lighting the match. And at that point, there was something about that that was just like, there's a casualness, not a maliciousness to it, but there's just a casualness to, we're just going to kill you now. But what that leads to is the reveal of her in the diner is what really sticks with me. It's all of a sudden, oh, this is just a normal person in the town. So it's
something
that
bigger going
it's
on.
That first reveal that part of the mob is somebody, A, that Dan knows and just it seems to be an integrated and sets the scene for every other reveal in the movie. Of, oh, here's this person that was involved in this horrible stuff, and here they are doing something just perfectly normal. But so the first reveal of the town, one of the killers is just part of the town, is mine.
My favorite moment probably is the when the family runs into the pole and then the subsequent chase through the house. It starts out really low-key where they're wandering into this abandoned house and they're looking around trying to find help. The kid got his head bonked when their car hit the phone pole. And they're wandering around this dilapidated house and they're like, hello, 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 go downstairs, see if you can find somebody. I'll go see if I can get an ice pack. And you see shadows fleeting in the background. You see movement just outside of the periphery of their vision. And then it slowly starts dialing up and it turns into this chase and you hear more panic in their voice and they're starting to get crowded in from the mob from town. They're opening doors and there's somebody behind them and it just keeps ratcheting up and ratcheting up and ratcheting up. And I thought that was a very well staged, very well executed, very suspenseful scene with a payoff.
Fair. And again, that was one of the, that was still when I thought, oh, it's ghosts. Because I had a very, very, somebody else has popped up. Oh, crap, it's all ghosts. And no, later it's just like zombies who knew the house.
So throughout this movie, as we've established, plenty of themes here and there. There's the town stopped in a time bubble, the disjointed, weird acting delivery. The one thing I've never been able to figure out, what do you think the cameras meant? Because every time the townspeople go out and kill somebody, there's the people doing the murders, but then everybody else, they have their little instamatics or and they're all just snapping the pictures.
It's capturing those moments and locking them in time, but a person's soul. Native American Indians used to hate to have their pictures taken because pictures taken, that picture is a representation of my soul.
Ooh, here's something I just thought of. So you've got Dobbs, and he is very much collecting the past, holding on to the past desperately. He's got his old-timey records. He's got his old-timey suit with the corsage. Mm-hmm. Is having him take the pictures also a capturing and remembering the past? Okay, it's a past that is now, but, you know, give it 3 weeks, a month, however long he's going to be doing this, it's his moment of now.
I could also say that. And then the pragmatic answer is, you know, Dobbs makes a big deal about this is my art and that they have to be disfigured so I can make them beautiful again. And the pictures are his reference to recreating their faces. I mean, so that's the pragmatic, boring, but probably realistic answer. But there is also, you know, in that final confrontation with Dobbs and Dan, he's using the footage. He's using the film. He's using the pictures. He's showing he's preserved all this information. So I think at the very least, they are memento mori. In the end, I think it's one of those, there is a thing where I like it when a film does something and then doesn't explicitly explain it, leaving it to the audience to put their own answers. And so in this case, it's simply, hey, there were these pictures being taken. The director clearly had a reason. It made for a great recurring theme and motif.
And it also gave you the shock value of the all of a sudden flashers are going off, and I wasn't expecting that. All of a sudden,
yes. Which I think made the fact that the first victim was a photographer very symbolic. But yeah, I like the fact that the film doesn't actually bother explaining it to us in any way. All it really does is facilitate that final scene, which is, I'm sure, an image the director wanted to get to.
One of the things that I find that bugged me about the film is that there's little handfuls of information that aren't given that we have to guess about. Like, we have to speculate about the cameras. I really would have liked it if there had been something more concrete. That's one ambiguous thing you shouldn't have left ambiguous.
I guess I'm a fan of white spaces.
Yeah, I appreciate
them. As a writer, white space is a very valuable
thing. I appreciate them too. Yeah. Something for them to guess with. And I don't mind being left with a guess. Mm-hmm. But the cameras in this were the one thing I didn't want as a guess.
All right, that's fair. All right. Well, there we go. Perfectly acceptable movie, even warts and all.
Yeah.
So, Dead and Buried. Was it appropriately left off of the prosecutor list?
Yes.
Absolutely. This was in no way anything that fit within the obscenity parameters. I mean, there was no reason to put this on the list whatsoever.
A little bit of nudity. The burning at the very beginning was kind of intense.
I don't know. I don't know that I see it. The nudity was literally blink and you'll miss it. It was like 5 seconds of here's her bare chest. And then the fire gag, I mean, it was really just a classic fire gag that any stuntman knows how to do. It's only intense because of the utter sense of helplessness that occurs. But again, the closest thing I could see in the whole movie would be the bit with the syringe in the eye.
going the Fulci route does tend to trigger Marianne or gang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But does it cross the line? Absolutely not. No. Not in a movie like this, and not how quickly they do these things. The editing is solid. And thus, nothing lingers. Unlike, say, Bay of Blood, where they...
Oh, they just drag that... That dragged on.
Dragged on, and they really linger on the gory shots. This one is, we did our gore, and moving on. So, no. Not at all. It was a stretch. It was the prosecution trying to cast too wide a net, which is why I think, in the end, this one got taken off.
All right. So, not on the list. Acquitted. Left off appropriately. There we go. So, Jeff.
Yeah.
Did you like Denberry?
Yes, absolutely. I did. It's aged from its era, you can tell. But as a movie, yeah, it was engaging. I got into the plot. I cared about what was happening about the characters. You know, the basic criteria is for at least engagement. And I thought it was a clever enough story.
Did you like it?
Oh, most certainly. When I sat down to watch this for the first time at the beginning of this week, I was 15, 20 minutes into it. And I really began to go, this is like, I'm feeling Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
Which really made me go, ooh, which drove my like up dramatically.
The movie, for me, it felt an awful lot like if George Romero, instead of doing Night of the Living Dead, did Invasion of the Body Snatchers for the Twilight Zone.
That's a good way of putting it.
That's quite a mashup, but sure, why not? In the end, what we're going to say about this, is it a mind-blowing masterpiece? No. Is it an enjoyable bit of cinema? Yeah,
sure. Absolutely.
And it was, frankly, it was a pleasant... If you guys had just said, even if we weren't recording this review right now, if I had come over for the afternoon and you had popped in this movie for us to watch in the background, I would have said, yeah, fair enough. That's good.
Well, thank you for joining us as we dissected Dead and Buried. Haha, mortician joke. And if you're sitting there thinking to yourself, man, I really need more Robert Englund on the list, don't worry, we've got him coming up in a couple of weeks with Eaten Alive. But, in the meantime, next week's episode, Deep River Savages, Back to the Green Hell. So, tell us how much you absolutely fucking hate cannibal movies by dropping us a note. TheVideoNastyProject@gmail.com, and, well, I guess we'll catch you next week. Stay evil.
Besides, discussion is terminated as far as I am concerned.